Okay, I'm ready to start now. A number of you emailed me things, and there's a lot to say, but since this is the last class, and I want to make sure I can today, maybe even finish with a few pages up, Frank, I'm going to push all that off to when we get back, when we pick up after Pesach. Truthfully, I don't even think we're going to finish those two pages up today, so we will be able to continue with Receipt Pesach when we continue after Pesach, because I don't think next Monday a lot of people will be traveling. Just one thing, I'll make a comment that Dovi Hoffman, we were speaking about who was ordained and not ordained, and he emailed me that Rosh Mazalman Auerbach was never ordained. And I'll actually ask him, if he's listening, to send me an email explaining how he knows that, because I would have assumed that Rav Yisrael Meltzer would have ordained him. In any event, a little later. There's a lot dealing with ordination I'll get to when we get back after Pesach. There was a quasi-ordination of a woman at the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale. I'm assuming all the Jewish newspapers will have material on it this coming week, and we can talk about that. But without any further ado, I want to get right into this. Is the eighth class of this semester, and it's the second class we're dealing with the Receipt Pesach Frank. We ended last class. I quoted you what the Encyclopedia Judaica said, that it says that the Receipt Pesach brought his halachic, brought proof to bear to halachically justify the appointment of Rav Kook as chief rabbi, and I said that I don't know of any such example of where he brought halachic proof. That wasn't really a debate. On the other hand, he did bring halachic proof, I said, in a different direction, not to defend Rav Kook as chief rabbi, but to actually shut down the being, unless we can call them extremists. The audio is okay. If you make sure you're plugged in properly. Everyone else told me they hear me. By the way, I'll just call your attention also, for those who are interested in the special relationship of Receipt Pesach and Rav Kook, I have this little booklet. You can enlarge my picture if you want to see me clearer. You just go to the lower right-hand corner and stretch it out, and you can enlarge. This is called Atere Tzvi. Kishrei HaYedidut, Bein Maranan V'Rabanan, Hagona V'Avra Mitzvah Kohen Kook, Rabba Shal Eretz Yisrael, Hagona Receipt Pesach Frank Zatzal, Rabba Shal Yerushalayim, not a big volume, a small one, but focuses completely on the relationship of Receipt Pesach Frank and Rav Kook from the writings and other things. You have similar pamphlets like this, one focusing on Rav Yisrael Meltzer and Rav Kook, another on Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Kook, and there's a fourth one, I forget now, and Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski. And I plan on doing a session on Rav Chaim Moser as well. Now, what do I mean when I say that Receipt Pesach Frank wanted to use halacha to shut down the separatists, the Eda Haribit? We don't have Receipt Pesach's letter, but we have Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski's letter, so we know what Receipt Pesach's position is. Rav Chaim Moser's letter appears in this book, Igros Rav Chaim Moser. It's a big, thick volume, and there's two of these. And he replies to Rosi Pesach. What's the context? The context is, after the establishment of the mandate, you had this thing, the Kehillah, the Vad HaLumi, where it had an official chief rabbinate. And then you had those, the extremists, because for the most part, these were people involved with, later known as the Eda Haredit, Hungarians, and some Prushim, some descendants of the Vilna Gaon's group, who refused to be involved in the general community for reasons, for understandable reasons, that this was also a community that encompassed the non-religious, and they would have involvement in determining salaries, etc., etc. And they set up their own community, a separate community recognized by the government, very much similar to what was in Germany. We spoke about the separatist communities. Receipt Pesach, ironically, also for a period of time, was not a member of the general community. He too was separate, although he was not part of this Eda Haredit Agudas Yisrael group. In fact, from about 1932 to 1936, he also was out of the official group. However, from his standpoint, it was not a political issue. That wasn't the concern. It wasn't like in Germany about paying taxes as far as he was concerned. he was speaking about, again, not Austria versus community in the German sense. He was concerned with an alternate of religious authority structure. From the Tzvi Pesach's position, you had a chief rabbi, Rav Kook, you had a Beis Din, you had Dayanim, and whether or not you paid taxes or involved with the general Vad Lomi, that was irrelevant. However, setting up a separate group where you say that the chief rabbi and his Dayanim are not authoritative, that to him is no less than what he terms Masi Gvul. You're coming in and trying to undermine the rabbinic leadership. You can read a lot about it, anyone who's interested, in this book by Menachem Friedman, Chevra Vadat, in which he talks, there's a great deal in here about Ritzi Pesach Frank, about the establishment of the chief rabbinate, etc. So he writes to Rafael Moser Grzinski, and let's not forget as well, the Lithuanian world, the Lithuanian yeshiva world, and the great rabbis, related to Rav Kook and to his Beis Din, as the religious leaders of the land of Israel. If you look in the letters of Rav Kook, you see loads and loads of letters to Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski back and forth. You don't find these with the Eda Haredi. These were a separatist group without any influence and without any real following. And things really begin to break down when you start having the Aliyah from Poland, the Ger Hasidim and the like, and they too want nothing to do with these separatists. So Rav Tzvi Pesach no doubt assumed that Rav Chaim Moser would be on his side in this. And this wasn't the beginning of his correspondence with him. He knew Rav Chaim Moser. There's other letters to him. One letter, for example, he recommends that Rav Chaim Moser come on Aliyah. And if he would come on Aliyah, he'd be able to stop some of the disputes, the machokas. Rav Chaim Moser obviously can't because he says that he's needed in Europe. In 1937, he suggests that Rav Chaim Moser become, after Rav Kook's death, he become Av Beis Din, basically chief rabbi of Jerusalem, a post that Rav Chaim Moser would himself soon fill. He thought that Rav Chaim Moser, that everyone would be able to accept Rav Chaim Moser and there wouldn't be any more separatism. But in 1933, I believe it is, maybe the end of 32, he writes to Rav Chaim Moser and asks him to shut the Yedah Haredi down. What's the situation? Well, Rav Sonnenfeld had recently passed away, and the Eda Haredit, the separatist group, wanted to bring in Rav Mendel Zak, who was the Rav in Riga, as chief rabbi of their small group. And he writes to Rav Chaim Moser and says, this is absolutely forbidden. They not only think they're going to have a chief rabbi, they want their own shrita, the whole thing, and that therefore, this would be the equivalent, I guess, in our day, if you have one Rav in town, and another Rav, and this Rav has a hashkacha, and runs a school and all this, and another Rav comes in and sets up an alternative shul, an alternative shchita and the like. Now, what's ironic is that this happens all the time in our communities. We're sort of used to it. But in a traditional community, this is absolutely forbidden. In traditional communities, you cannot open up another synagogue unless the kehila structure gives you permission. In many places in Europe, only one synagogue was permitted. And you weren't allowed to have another synagogue. You certainly were not allowed to have another Rav set up an alternative Beis Din. When you start having chaos and anarchy, then anyone can do what they want to do. And we saw how that happened in Eastern Europe. You began to have breakaway groups. The Hasidim began to break away. You had it in other places. This is what Ritzi Pesach is trying to prevent, that there should be one kehila with one Rav and Dayanim. Otherwise, as I said, you get to the situation we have today where it's complete chaos and you have everyone making their own standards. I do think, however, although we have all this chaos in the West here in America, I think many of us like the chaos. It's sort of like the free market model. We choose which rabbi we want to go to. We choose which hashkacha we want to accept. But that's not how it ran in the traditional kehila. So we see here where Rav Tzvi Pesach was ideologically. Rav Chaim Moser replies to him. For those who want to see it, it's in his letters, volume 2, number 7-64. Rav Chaim Moser begins his reply by saying that he never got involved in the religious politics of the land of Israel. And that's true. And that's unlike his brother-in-law. We will have a little section in a future class on Rav Elchanan Wasserman. And Rav Elchanan Wasserman did get involved. He sent letters and public declarations about things going on in Israel, about there was Yivrit. Is it necessary to employ only Jews if they're more expensive and you can get Arabs? And Rav Chaim Moser was very surprised and upset that his brother-in-law, Rav Elchanan, interfered in what's going on in the land of Israel. Rav Chaim Moser did not involve himself. Well, you make a good point. The feeling that we need unity, but I don't know if that was the only issue. I mean, if you look at many of the disputes, the issue wasn't so much the anti-Semites. I'm talking about internal disputes. The Nitziv does mention that, but that's because he was concerned about also the separatist groups would approach the non-Jews and really have a separate. Many of them speak about, as you know well, and I sent you some stuff on this about the idea of Achdus. That they were very afraid of, especially with Pesach Hasidim, for example. You have a Rav in town and a Beis Din, he's giving halacha. The Hasidim come around and they put up their own Rav. He's going to start passing differently, and that's going to create chaos in the community. Which Rav's authority? When does Shabbos end? Which Shochet is reliable? As we'll see, Pesach was very involved in this as well. How can you have a community when one Rav says a Shochet is permissible and another Rav says he's forbidden? It creates all sorts of problems, which is why we have VODs now in America. Why do you need a VOD? Why can't you just have a Rav? Because you want to have a situation where if someone has a Simcha or something of the like, that everyone in town can accept Shkaka and there's no problems. We have a situation where one Rav has one opinion and another has another one. You can't really even have people eat together if they're not holding the same position. So with the VOD, you have have unified standards. The downside is, as we've mentioned on many occasions, is that means that you have to go to the highest denominator, I guess you could say, or the most strict position. But in any event, that was the situation in Eastern Europe. Yeah, exactly. The Chaim Ozer, and they said, begins by saying that he's never involved himself in the land of Israel, and then he starts talking about why an Eidah Haredit was established. And he says right from the beginning that right now this group has been around, it's been around, I guess, around 12 years. It's a fait accompli. And if Rabbi Pesach and the other Rabbani wanted to shut them down, they should have done it when it started. But now it's been around for a number of years, so they have a chazak, as it were. And then he says he knows why Rav Kook doesn't want to separate and why Rav Kook feels it's important to be in the larger community. Now, again, it's ironic, because at this time, Rav Tzvi Pesach is himself technically not involved in the on the other hand, he is involved in the larger community in that he's responsible for all the divorces and all the marriages and everything like that, whereas the Eidah Haredit wanted to completely cut themselves off from the wider community. I don't know if Chaim Moshe realized this, that Rav Tzvi Pesach's position was not so much a communal one like you had in Germany, because he portrays the Rav Kook dispute with the Eidah Haredit not as really a religious authority dispute. Who is the Rav? Who's in charge of religious standards? He portrays it simply as an issue like in Germany, where Rav Chaim Moshe has a famous why some people feel it's important to remain in a larger community, and he describes Rav Kook this way because Rav Kook could influence the non-religious, etc., and why some people feel it's important to separate from the larger community. Now, if you have choices, we're very American, we believe you have a choice to have your own Rav. The problem is your own Rav is often going to be undermining the other Rav, because he's going to give his own decisions. The traditional Kehila structure was an authoritarian structure. Rav determined everything in the community religiously. It wasn't the free market structure that we now have in America. Although that now, because maybe we won't like the rabbis they give us. If you look in Eastern Europe, when traditional religious communities began to fall, they thought this was a very tragic thing. You see this even in the 18th century within the Yaakov Emden dispute. He opened up his own shul in his house, which was illegal, because no other shul was permitted. Yeah, of course. Let me go on a little. We'll come back to some of these comments. Rav Chaim Ozer then said that the separatist communities actually helped the Orthodox. And this was the same point, then the separatist communities helped the communal, the unified communities. And the same point was made in Germany. Because if the non-religious know that the Orthodox could always leave them and stop paying taxes and go join the separatists, that keeps the non-religious worried and willing to make compromises for the Orthodox. There's no question that in Germany, the general communities were afraid that the Orthodox would leave the general community, and therefore they bent over backwards to make them happy. So he says, first of all, you, Ritzi Pesach, shouldn't be upset with the Yeda Haribi because they allowed you to gain concessions from the general community. Again, this wasn't Ritzi Pesach's issue. However, that's what he says. Second of all, Rav Chaim Loser says that it's good to have people, these separatists, who can be straightforward. They don't have to flatter the non-religious. If you're in one community with them, you have to sit together with them at meetings, you have to do this. Rav Chaim Loser says it's good to have extremists who can actually speak what they think is the truth without having to worry about niceties because they're working with the non-religious on a day-to-day basis. That's an interesting perspective. Therefore, instead of opposing the Yehuda Haredi, you should actually try to assist them because they'll be on their side and you'll be on yours. Again, the problem with this is that the Yehuda Haredi was not just about a separatist organization that wanted to be by itself and run their own religious services. They saw it as part of their mission to undermine the authority of Rav Kook and show him as an illegitimate, not just him as illegitimate, all the rabbanim who associated with him as illegitimate. So it wasn't really a communal separatist dispute like in Germany. It was very much about religious authority structure, and I haven't seen anyone really who's made this point in writing about this dispute, but that's exactly what it was with Ritzi Pesach. It might not have been that way with others. However, with Ritzi Pesach, that was the issue. Religious authority, not an issue of that you're joined together with the heretics, is that permissible, etc. That was the German issue, not the issue in the land of Israel. Sounds like, but the Chazon Ish was a little more extreme, because the Chazon Ish, although he did write in his letters, he wrote against the Yehuda Haredi when they said that you couldn't be a Rav, he himself had no interest in his followers actually becoming part of the Dayanim structure. But it is similar to the Chazon Ish, in a sense, you're right. Now, the Rav Kook himself had no problems with the Razana thought on a personal basis. Although they would have nothing to do, the Yehuda Haredi would have nothing to do with Rav Kook. So even if Ritzi Pesach and Rav Kook took the advice from Chaim Loser, it wouldn't solve anything because the extremists wouldn't have anything to do with him. In fact, when Rav Zonnenfeld died, Rav Kook wanted to go to the funeral. They used to meet occasionally at weddings and at brisses and the like. If you look in the art scroll book on Rav Zonnenfeld, it tells a story how when they were together at a bris. I remember I mentioned last class how ironic it is that today the Haredim see themselves as followers of Rav Zonnenfeld and have this biography of Rav Zonnenfeld. And this biography is not like the three-volume Marad Ari Yisrael, which casts Rav Kook as basically a heretic. However, this biography, which is very much telling the story from Rav Zonnenfeld's side by a grandson, but not a Yehuda Haredi type, he places Rav Kook and Rav Zonnenfeld basically equal. Of equal authority, and we'll see in a minute what Ritzi Pesach has to say about that. Yeah, that is true. There's good stuff in those letters. So when Rav Kook wanted to go to Rav Zonnenfeld's funeral, Ritzi Pesach refused to let him. Ritzi Pesach said to him, I will lay down on the street in front of the car so that you are forbidden to go. You will not be able to go. Why did Ritzi Pesach refuse to let him go? Because he knew that if he went there, there would be trouble and that they would degrade Rav Kook. And as Rav Zonnenfeld's followers degraded Rav Kook on other occasions, once when coming out of one of the yeshivas, I think it was the Torah Chaim Yeshiva, they threw garbage on his head. You know, these were the people who had a, quote, trial and hung Rav Kook in effigy. There was even stories that there was a person who wanted to kill Rav Kook and was going to stab him. So Rav Ritzi Pesach said, refused to let him go to the funeral. This story is quoted by Rav Avraham Shapiro, about who we'll do next semester, and Rav Avraham Shapiro, as I'll explain, his traditions and his stories can be relied upon. If you ask me what the correct manner to behave is express your disagreements respectfully, and to each their own. However, in the traditional community, and I think this gets back to your question, in the traditional community, people were not given that authority, that right, within the community. If they had a problem, they had to leave the community. They can have their disagreements, obviously, but you cannot disagree publicly with the Rav, and you couldn't set up a different authority structure. I'm sure many of you have been in communities where a breakaway group tries to establish a shul, and the rabbis are not too happy, to put it mildly. Often, however, the breakaway group, this is how it worked in Eastern Europe. Whenever a breakaway group opened up, the rabbis would get other big rabbis to declare this breakaway group forbidden. And you can't have anything to do with them, you can't step foot in their shul, etc. So their shul fate isn't forbidden, etc. Then the breakaway group, invariably, would get other big rabbis to send them letters saying, to break away, why? And they list the reasons. This rabbi doesn't like Hasidim, this rabbi doesn't that. So really, for the last 200 years, anyone who's wanted to break away had an easy time because you could always find a big rav who would write a letter saying that you have authority to break away. We spoke last class how when this group in London, the Machziki Adas, when the Posek Hador, Rav Yitzchak Chaim Inspector, as well as other great Gedolim said it was forbidden to break away, they wanted to break away, so they got other rabbis to support them. You can always find someone. But if you look back before the last couple hundred years, you had unified communities. And again, we can debate whether that's the best thing or not, but that's the way that was always the traditional Jewish approach. No, in modern times, there was always machokas, but you had a rav. And the people who disagreed with them usually would be put in cheirem, or they would have to leave the city, or they would, I mean, you never actually had, in smaller communities, separate shuls. You just hated the rav. But you didn't set up a separate authority structure, because then you would be put in cheirem. The only way that a cheirem doesn't matter is if you have your own community. Because then you don't, what does a cheirem mean? A cheirem means you can't go to shul. No, every Jew has to go to shul. We're not dealing with heretics here. But if you're not permitted in the shul and you're not, no one talks to you, et cetera, you can't live like that. So when you have the Hasidim and you have the other groups and you have a complete group, well, then you don't care if they put you in chayrim because you set up your own shul and you have everything you need. You have your own shochet. You have everything you want in the other group. But if you're asking what the ultimate is to be able to live with other people, even though you have different synagogues, not to disrespect their leaders, and to each go your own way. There's 70 facets to the Torah. Unfortunately, in modern times, together with these breakaways, usually what we have here is most people, or many people, can't understand this, and they end up degrading, either attacking the people on the right or attacking the people on the left. It's a real problem with the Jews. There's not a problem with machlokas, with arguments, per se. The Talmud's full of them. But there are certain arguments, the rabbis tell us, that are arguments like Korach. They're not designed to live on because they're not based, they're based on personal things, etc. Let us move on. Rav Chaim Osher ends his letter as follows. And remember, he's writing to Rav Tzvi Pesach, another Litvak, Rav Kukta Litvak, the Basin's Litvak, and he's writing in defense of Hungarians who he really has nothing to do with. But still, Rav Chaim Osher was an Ish Emet, a man of truth, and this is how he had to come down. He writes to Rav Tzvi Pesach, with all the honor I have for you and the other rabbis, he means the rabbis in Rav Kook's group, and this included great, great names. The truth is more beloved of all. And after considering this matter with the other great rabbis in our community, we have found no basis to prevent the separatists from appointing a replacement for Rav Zonnenfeld. And that's how he ends the letter. Yet, I tell you now, even if Rav Chaim Osher had sent a letter that it is forbidden for the separatists to appoint another rav, they wouldn't have stopped them, because Rav Chaim Osher was not their Gadol Hador. However, Rav Mendel Zak from Riga, he would have listened, and others would have listened, Zell Ruben Dennis. But they would have found a Hungarian rav. I mean, they could have appointed the Satmar rav to head of it. If you listen to the Satmar rav and what he says about the Aguda leaders like Rav Chaim Osher, believe me, there's no love lost. But they wanted to get a Lithuanian type. They always, the Eda Charedi always wanted to expand their influence. Now, one of the issues that Rav Tzvi Pesach was so concerned with was a separate Shechita. And if you look at the polemics between the different groups, the different breakaway groups, this is always an issue. Because whenever a separatist group is established in Eastern Europe or in Hungary, the first thing they do is bring in their own Shechita. And you can understand all the problems this is. So we live in times when people are always, how do you delegitimize the other? You say that their shlita is no good, or that their kashrus is no good. It's also a business technique. It's always been a business technique ever since the rise of the hashkachas in the early 20th century. If you want to get more business, the best way to do it is to cast aspersions on the other. That's unfortunate, but that's the reality. It's very rare to have a city, find a city where you only have one hashkacha. And Tzvi Pesach was very cognizant of this. So much so that after Rav Chaim Ozer said that he's not going to forbid the Yedah Charedit from continuing, Rav Tzvi Pesach says, you know, if they get their own shlita, if the only time they didn't yet have their own shlita, he says that we should shut down our shlita and buy all our meat from the Yedah Charedit shlita. So Rav Tzvi Pesach was so concerned about this aspect of machlokas, where people would not be able to eat with each other, that he says, and he was in charge of shlita, one of the people in charge in Jerusalem, that, and that's where they made a lot of money also, that's, and there was taxes on the shlita. Rav Tzvi Pesach said, and this is recorded in this book, Hatzvi Yisrael, which is the volume about him, he says that in order for Shalom Bayis, if the Yedah Charedit is not willing to give up their shlita, we will give up our shlita. So at least there'll only be one shlita in Jerusalem. It's interesting, though, that although that Rav Pesach was so concerned about unified shlita, so at least you have, in terms of food, you have one community, because it's not like today we have all this packaged food and everything. Think back to Jerusalem in the 30s. Everyone has to buy their meat, you know, you go to the shochet and you get your meat. If you have a situation there where you have different shlitas and one doesn't accept the other, and that would have been the reality, because the Yedah Charedit would not have accepted the Rabbanut. Rav Tzvi Pesach said, you know, let's have one shlita. Today you have numerous shlitas, and if you go to Israel, you have packages, even things like lettuce, which will have four or five different hashkachas. And if you have a wedding there, have it, to satisfy every different type of hashkacha in every group, it's become almost impossible. And a lot of this is business, and a lot of this is funkeit. There was a time, however, when Rav Tzvi Pesach insisted on two shlitas. And this is when, getting back to Rav Uziel, who we spoke about how Rav Uziel was a big compromiser with the Ashkenazim. He thought that you can compromise. And one of the things was, he said, he agreed to get rid of levirate marriage for Sfardim. And we saw that Rav Avadya Yosef overturned that and said that Rav Uziel, he didn't stick up for the Sephardic approach. He allowed himself to give in to the hegemony of the Ashkenazim. Well, another thing that Rav Uziel wanted to do is he said that the Sephardim will give up their shlita, all in the name of Shalom. Rav Uziel bent over too much for Shalom Bayis. He saw the Ashkenazim. The Ashkenazim have all these issues. He wanted them to be happy and to make peace with the Sephardim, and therefore he said he was willing to give up his own standards in the name of peace, something Rav Avadya has been obviously very opposed to. When this happened, Rav Tzvi Pesach said, absolutely not. Because the issue with the Sephardim is that they have to eat Galat Kosher. We all know what Galat Kosher is, and I don't mean today Galat. In fact, there's a whiskey, which has on it in big letters. I'll send a copy of this if anyone wants to see it, OU Galat. So now you have the OU. At first it started with the Galat chickens, and then Galat fish, and now you have Galat whiskey, and next thing you know, will be Galat toilet bowl cleaner. You know, many of you read my post about the toilet bowl cleaner. This was always a joke, because 5 years ago, when I saw with the candles with hashkachas and the detergent, I said, soon they're going to have toilet bowl cleaner with hashkacha, and I was just joking. And lo and behold, we have that now, and not just in America. Stanley Emerson sent me from Israel, and I posted about it on the Sephardim blog. But now you have Galat Kosher, which is not really Galat Kosher. It's just it just means it's a better hashkacha, but Sephard, it's not Beit Yosef. It's not, there are still some adhesions on the lung. And we don't have time to hang on correspondence with a couple of you all offline, because at the end of the day here, all this Galat Kosher stuff, which is forcing Ashkenazim to eat something which they're not required to eat, is taking money out of our pockets. For us, it might only be $100, $200 a year, but when you talk about schools and institutions, which have huge budgets, all I can say is the OU opinion to force people to pay more, and it is forcing, because you cannot get today what's reliably regarded as non-glot meat. So therefore, these institutions who are trying to provide scholarships and the like for people, they're forced to pay extra. I think it's the Marshal who says you can't have glot because it takes money out of Jews' hands. So in my opinion, that's a scandal of another sort, but be that as it may, you have to eat Beit Yosef. the abstract, and we get the questions here. If it could be breaking up because you're wireless. Oxygen next. I don't know. We'll see. But there is a Hector. There is a permission. When I say that technically Sfardim have to be Glock, that's because the Beit Yosef says it. However, you often have Sfardim who then get on this from binge. When I was in Israel, there was some guy who decided to go vegetarian. Because in those days, today all the meat in Israel seems to be Beit Yosef. When I was in Israel, 84, 85, it was regular kosher. And we had an Egyptian there, Tamachachem. Now he's Tamachachem. I don't think he was then, or I don't know if he was then. He was just like one of us, a Flatbush graduate. He decided he wasn't going to eat the meat because it wasn't Beit Yosef. And he also, Avadia has a tshuva in which he says that although yes, Sfardi must eat Beit Yosef, that doesn't mean that if you're invited to someone's house or if you're invited to a wedding or the like and they're not serving glatt, that you don't eat it. He says you do eat it. And he says it's a sex faker, that maybe there really aren't any adhesions, and maybe the halacha is that you don't have to eat glatt. The point is, of glatt for Sfardim is not that you can't eat in anyone else's house. It's not like that at all. But he does say that Sfardim, when they buy meat, have a bit of a higher standard, because they never accepted the Ramah. The Ramah says that you don't need to eat glatt. You can accept certain adhesions on the lung. For Sfardim, they have to. So when Rav Uziel said that for Shalom Bayis, we will compromise on this, Rav Tzvi Pesach said, absolutely not. And then if Rav Uziel is going to compromise, I will set up a Sfardek Shchita. And Rav Uziel backed down when he heard that. We're going to be dealing next semester with the Moroccans, Rav Nessas. So many people don't realize this, that the Moroccans, believe it or not, although they are followers of the Beit Yosef, and in general they follow everything to Shulchan Aruch, they accepted non-glot as well. That's interesting that you say about the Beis Medrash in Gavoa in Lakewood. That's because we don't have Rubashkin anymore, the meal march and the like, although it says glot, it's not real glot. So they provided for it. But years ago, they wouldn't have provided for them. You had Syrians going to Lakewood from the days of Jose Faor. In the 50s and 60s, you had Syrians in Lakewood. They ate meat like everyone else. As far as I know, they meet like everyone else. It's only Rav in the early part, Rav Shama told me that no one ever had glatt in the Syrian community earlier. And there's a tshuva of Rav Shmuel Abuhav, I believe, who is the justification for not having glatt. But again, that's in a situation where you can't get things, you're safe. Now, those of you who go down to Deal, I go to Deal during the summer, you go to the supermarket, they all have real bait, you're safe glatt. That's true. It's Bishul Akum, and Rav Avadia has a tshuva about Bishul Akum as well, with the same justification. Before moving on, let me call attention to another letter by Rav Tzvi Pesach, which sheds light on this entire dispute and shows how much he was in Rav Kook's camp. Now, this letter is an amazing letter. I actually discovered this letter, I think. What do I mean, discovered this letter? I was one of the few who knew about it. Because I told you how when I went to Brandeis University, I discovered Rav Chaim Hirschenson's Malki Rakodesh. In those days, who knew about Chaim Hirschenson? Who cared? Who read about him? Nowadays, everyone's studying Rav Chaim Hirschenson. The only thing written about him was this tiny book by Eliezer Schweid that appeared, I think, in 79 or 81. And Louis Jacobs, in his book, We Have Reason to Believe, mentions Chaim Hirschenson. I do not know. Now I could check, Google Books. There might be one other person or two. But I had never, ever seen any references to Rav Chaim Hirschenson other than those. So I started studying the work, and lo and behold, a long letter from Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, in which he calls him his relative. I don't know what it means, his relative. And after I discovered this letter, I would tell people about it. A few years ago, someone posted on a blog, and then it was on another blog, and lo and behold, and I'll read you sections, but Salamoa came across it also. But I used to tell people about this letter because it was quite amazing. Now, I found that this letter, the halachic parts, also appears in the Har Tzvi. Now, I don't know if Rav Tzvi Pesach was happy when this letter was published. It was a personal letter. This appeared in Malki Bakodesh in, I think, in 1930. We could check, 28, 29, one of the early volumes. However, once it's appeared, it is very illuminating. In fact, it's the most illuminating to let us know really what Rafi Pesach was thinking and what he was going through. So much so that when Hyde Park, where a lot of bibliophiles and lovers of books to deal with things, and there's a thing called dealing with just with Svarim on it. And someone posted this, and there was all sorts of discussion, and I was reading the Haredim who were commenting. They couldn't believe this. They never heard it. And, of course, in typical Haredi fashion, someone suggested it must be forged. That's, I don't know how a letter published in the Rafi Pesach's lifetime is forged, but it's an amazing letter. So let me tell you about it. Okay, thank you. It appears in Malki Bakodesh, Volume 4, page 43. We discussed some of this letter in the classes on Chaim Hirschenson. It's where Rafi Pesach takes Hirschenson to task about his views of Stam Yenam and non-religious Jews. But Hirschenson had written to Rafi Pesach asking him, what's going on in Jerusalem? He had come from Jerusalem. And all you heard when you were in Chutz La'aretz is terrible machlokas, terrible dispute. Let me just read sections of this letter as it speaks for itself. It's translated by Betzalel Na'or in this wonderful book. It's Betzalel Na'or's translation of Orot, which is a wonderful translation, but the best part, in my opinion, is the introduction of some 60 pages where he really sets the stage. And first of all, he shows you what was it about Rav Kook that his opponents found so objectionable. What was it about Orot, the famous chapter on exercise and the like, and Rav Karlach. And he explained the whole dispute. And he found the letter, or someone showed him the letter, and he quotes a large section of it, which I will read. This is, as I said, the most illuminating, not just for Rafi Pesach, but what was going on in Jerusalem. And when I'm reading you the letter, think how similar it is today. All these people today talk about how these Yisurim, these Chayrims come about, and it seems like nothing has changed in 70 years. Betzalel Na'or begins by saying that, why is he going to quote it? Because of the tremendous halachic stature of the Gaon Rafi Pesach Frank, it is worthwhile to cite this passage in its entirety to serve as a corrective to much of the revisionist history concerning the Cook-Zonenfeld dispute, which unfortunately passes in Orthodox circles today as authoritative. What does he mean by revisionist history? Like I said already, the idea that Rav Kook was somehow some sort of left-wing modern Orthodox rabbi, and that in the yeshiva world, he was on the outs. Listen, I'll read some of the sentences. He begins by saying, I want to let you know what's going on here in Jerusalem. The Gaon, our master, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, was accepted here as Rav by the majority of the holy community here. It is well known that the members of the Hungarian Kohel, not Kohel in the sense where you sit and learn all day, Kohel in they have these groups, which was supported by money from Chutz La'aretz, are envious of our Russian and Polish brethren. Especially so that the proceeds earmarked to the Hungarians should increase, it is not good for them that the chief rabbi of the Holy City be other than Hungarian. So he begins by saying that there's a monetary aspect here. They want to have their own, quote, chief rabbi, that is the Hungarians, the small group of Hungarians. It'll help them raise money to support their people. So what did the members of Kohel Ungarn do? A few of them gathered together. At their head, the old lad. I forget who this is. I think his name is Hoffman, some extremist who created all sorts of troubles for Rav Kook. They called him the old lad. He propagandized to found Vod Ashkenazi, the Ashkenazic Council. Now this old lad is a great expert in arranging elections hidden from all, revealed only to him. The entire election process is invisible. It is difficult to describe in writing his diligence in this matter. He's writing, speaking very sarcastically here. He puts together a list of a large committee, also a steering committee. On the surface, all is lovely. In other words, he sends out these letters, and there's a whole steering committee and everything. It seems as if there's a whole community in opposition to Rav Kook. It's like these organizations that have a million board members, and these people have no idea of what does it mean to be a board member. On the surface, all is lovely. On the inside, all is rotten. For from the ranks of the Hungarians and the Galicians, he picks youngsters. And from the other Kohelim, when he sees an old man or imbecile who won't understand his tricks, he brings him into the Vod. No, he's picking these phonies and setting these up as great rabbis and the like. So the result is, of the invisible election is that he is the secretary and the young fellow the chairman. They write and send tens of thousands of letters to America and the entire world in the name of all the Ashkenazim in Jerusalem. That's how they sign their letters. We'll see what Zonnefeld finds himself as Rosh HaBeis to Mikol Ashkenazim. You know, they're the rabbi of all the Ashkenazim. They say that Rav Chaim Zonnenfeld is the Rav here. When we all see and know that Rav Chaim Zonnenfeld was never and will not be the Rav. For he is an old, frail man for whom it is not possible to get involved in the affairs of the town. But this old lad uses him and his name as a pawn to destroy an entire city. If you want to see how this works, there is a video that's been going around recently. I can send a link if anyone's interested. There's also it's very hard to understand Rav Yashav in it, and a transcript of it was published. You can see two jokers sitting at the table with Rav Yashav, speaking to him and trying to get him to come out with bands and things of the like, and they take themselves. But anyone watching this, it's unbelievable how they try to take an old man and take advantage of him and ask the same question in 20 different ways to get him to declare things forbidden. He and his gang of empty fellows publicly, brazenly insult the Gaon, you know, Reb Kook. The old lad got together with young writers who frequent the house of the ancient Reb Yitzchak Yeruchim Diskin, for this old man is under the influence of the young secretaries. They manipulate him whichever way they please and obtain his signature for all their antics. In my estimation, he is not guilty at all, for he cannot see the writing. He's blind, and they're able to get his signature on things. And signing is also difficult for him. The secretaries made for him a stamp of his signature, which is an exact replica, and they write and sign whatever they please. Woe to a generation whose leaders are such lads, little foxes. It happens today. You know how many times these signs go up in Me'ash Arim, which have the signatures of great rabbis, then the great rabbis declare that they had nothing to do with it? About 6 weeks ago, I spoke with Rav Chaim Zonnenfeld, and at one point I asked him if it is right that he signs himself the Rav of the Ashkenazim in our holy city. He answered that the truth is he himself does not sign it, but they made a stamp and wrote this on it. And you can see the stamp. The Gaon, our master, Rav Kook, is the Rav here. All the large institutions are under his presidency. He is the Rav of the city and carries the burden of the community. Etc., etc. And he goes on and on and saying, tell everyone what's going on here, etc., etc., and all the problems that they're making for us, so that people are not blind to what's going on. It's amazing. When I was in Toronto a few months ago, so those of you in Toronto know Dr. Tibor Judah, who's the son-in-law of Rav Hirschsprung. Let me tell you what he told me his father in law said, or Hirschsprung. Hirschsprung was the greatest scholar in Montreal, and probably the whole entire Canada for many years, a Gaon of immense proportions. A Gaon from when he was like 13, 14 years old. Incredible. Studied under a mayor of Lublin. This just gives you a sense of how things are different then with today, of how the traditional yeshiva were regarded Rav Kook. He says as follows. I'm quoting. This is rehearsed from. Rav Kook was the Gadol, the great Gadol. Rav Zonnenfeld, he was a Talmud Chacham. For the Hungarians, even a great Talmud Chacham. But to compare him to Rav Kook is absurd. Here you have a bit of a Polish mocking of the Hungarians. He says, Rav Zonnenfeld, a Talmud Chacham. For the Hungarians, even a great Talmud Chacham. But you see here this reflection of people who knew the time, that, yes, Rav Kook was Zonnenfeld, the great Talmud Chacham, but you can't compare him to Rav Kook. Rav Kook was recognized by the entire world as Rav of Jerusalem, except a bit of an exaggeration, because the Hungarians, of course, the anti-Zionist Hungarians, did not recognize Rav Kook, but we're talking about the Litvish world. Now, in the Eda Haredi book, Mar D'Ar Yisrael, it claims that on his deathbed, Rav Pesach Frank repented for all of his crimes. What was his crimes? For being with Rav Kook, for staying in the chief rabbinate, for being on the Moetzes Rabbinate HaRashit, the chief rabbinical council. And how do they know this? Of course they don't know this, but it's valuable testimony, what they say. It's valuable, I mean, to recount this testimony, even though it's completely false, but he's too big. they need to grab them. What you need to do with people when they're too big is you can't reject them. You want to pull them into your camp as well. So every time you have a great sage who, unless he's totally against you, but if you feel that he had certain aspects that were similar to you, and we'll see Pesach did have a couple toes in the Haredi world, the ultra Haredi world, that is, as we'll see in a minute, you don't want to leave him to the other side. So what do you do? Well, you say he repented, and we have many examples of this. This is really what the dispute at Rishi Yaakov Weinberg's funeral is all about. Does he belong with us, with the Rosh Yeshiva, or does he belong with you, with the religious Zionist, and the like? Listen to what are some of Ritzi Paschal's other crimes that make this, they should have just given up on him and put him together with Rav Kook and Rav Herzler. We'll see in a minute why they felt it was important to try to grab him. Not just the fact that he's a great, obviously, Torah scholar from the old Yeshiva and the like, but listen to some of the things. He gave all sorts of psukim for the Haganah. They would come to him, and he paskened for them. At the end of the mandate, right before the war, weapons were stored in his basement, on his house in Rehov Malachi. Not only that, future operations, the Haganah, were planned in his basement, as well as bombs were made in the basement of Ritzi Pesach's house. His house was actually close to an important British army base, and therefore a telephone line was to Haganah headquarters so that when movements of the British were observed, immediately this information would be passed to Haganah headquarters. He was part and parcel of the Haganah machine, which is only fitting because he was the Rav of Jerusalem, not the Rav of a small group, he was the Rav of everyone. Glatt kosher bombs. I shouldn't say glatt kosher because they didn't have glatt kosher so much then. But certainly kosher bombs. Hetzer Mechira bombs, as we'll see in a minute. He also ruled, just with regard to the British, he ruled that the British ban on Aliyah, you had people who came to him and said, is it permissible for us to break the ban? You had these underground movement bringing people in, especially after the Holocaust, into Israel, into the land of Israel. I'm sure most of you know the underground Aliyah. I mean, the white paper began before the war, but certainly after the war it started up, but then Ritzi Paschal didn't deal with it then. He did deal with it then, but it began before the war also, the white paper. What was the purpose of the white paper? Well, the Arab pressure and all that. So therefore, Jewish emigration was basically stopped, whereas before that there was a lot of Jewish immigration. Ritzi Paschal said, we are not bound by this. And it is, you know, you have this concept of din l'machus l'dina, that we are obligated to obey the law of the land. And that applies, even if the law of the land is somewhat discriminatory, but there's a limit. It can't be super discriminatory. Why do I say somewhat discriminatory? Today, none of us would accept din l'machus. If the government passed a rule, for example, that Jews have to pay higher taxes or something, we would say that this is invalid. And it's not binding. But historically, every government in history was an anti-Semitic government. Until you get to the American government, right, the founding of America, every government in history was anti-Jewish to some levels, to some extent. And the laws of Dina de Mahusa were established thousands of years ago, when Jews were living under Roman rule and Babylonian rule. And in all those societies, Jews were second-class citizens and were persecuted. So this notion that if the government is anti-Semitic, then Dina de Mahusa doesn't apply, that's not correct. But the rabbis distinguish in the post-scheme between a little anti-Semitic and a lot of anti-Semitic. That is, a certain amount of anti-Semitism is to be expected. And they never said that Dina de Mahusa is not applicable if Jews are discriminated a little. They expected that. After all, until America is established, Jews are always discriminated against. That's basic to life. And yet they still said that Dina de Mahusa applies. However, if they had persecuted you too much, then it's considered the robbery of the government. Then it's the persecution that doesn't apply. And there have been disputes about this. In the early years of the Nazi regime, it's reported that Rav Chanan Wasserman thought that this was a valid government. And Din Mahusa applied. And Rav Chaim Ozer rebuked him and said, absolutely not. Ritzi Paschal said that this ban on immigration is directed only against Jews. it's too burdensome, and therefore we are not bound by dealing the Malchusa. We can violate this, and we can smuggle people in, and the like. He was a realist. When the partition plan came up, there were those who wanted to oppose it, because they said, although we'll be getting a state, we are forbidden to accept something which removes part of biblical Israel. And therefore, we can't accept it. I'm not referring to the Satmar types who said that we're opposed to any state before the coming of the Messiah. I'm referring to people who said that we would be acknowledging that certain parts of the land are not ours and we're giving them to the Arabs. Ritzvi Pesach said nonsense. And he agrees with Chaim Moser, who spoke about this even before the war, that we don't have any responsibility. We're not making the rules. If we were making the rules, of course we couldn't give it away. However, we're not making that rule. We just have, we're given the option of this or nothing, and therefore we can absolutely take it. Take what they're giving us. He was a strong opponent of the rising extremism. He noted that the prohibition of being like Korach applies even when you are l'shem shamayim, that is, even when your intentions are pure or good. There's still a prohibition on creating conflict and the like. And that's important to note, because you had these people in Jerusalem, and I'll acknowledge that a lot of them, a lot of these extremists, a lot of these people fomenting all this machokas, that they have good intentions. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. They need to be opposed, and they need to, we want to shut them down. Because even if your intentions are pure, you can still be like Korach. Now, following the death of Rav Kook, Ritzvi Pesach was chosen Av Beis Din of Jerusalem, basically chief rabbi of Jerusalem. And you can read about the politics of this in Friedman's book. How was he chosen? He was chosen that all the dayanim and the religious leaders, the heads of institutions, got together and chose him as chief rabbi for the Ashkenazi. And that's how these things always happened. However, the official powers, that is the British and the Zionists, they refused to actually accept that, because they said you have to go through a real election and the like. And he wasn't at first crowned chief rabbi. Later on, I believe he was officially, when the State of Israel came to be. So he only had the title Av Beis Din for many years. Now, what are some of the important rulings he's known for? We mentioned a few of them. He has many volumes of responsa known as Har Tzvi. They're on the Bar Ilan, you know, one of the most important volumes of Tshuvot in the post-World War II era. We could spend many classes focusing on his various rulings, but let me just call attention to a few of them that I think move beyond just the particular aspect of the Tshuva and speak to larger concerns. One, I mentioned this, months ago or even last year in a previous class, but I'll repeat it, and that's he was confronted what to do with a case of Mamzerus and more than one case after the war. Let me tell the story. And we have testimony for people who were involved with this. Rav Shmuel Weingarten and Aaron Pachenik, leading Mizrahi figures. Pachenik, if I'm not mistaken... I forget what he wrote. But he's a leading Mizrahi figure from America, then went to Israel. You had a woman, who during the war was separated from her husband, assumed he was killed, went to Israel. The husband came to America. It's not like today, or in those days after the war, to find your husband and wife, it was very difficult. There was all sorts of lists. It's not like computers or anything and the like. She was given a heter to remarry. This is in B'nai Brak. She remarries. She has children. The sons, I believe there were two sons, are learning in Ponevej, the Tzirim, in the Ponevej, the younger Ponevej division. Her husband had gone to America. He comes to Israel on a trip. In those days, you know, the trip was a big deal. But, he goes to B'nai Brak. You know, but in those days, also, Jerusalem was not such a... I believe this was the early 50s. Jerusalem wasn't like it is today. You still had plenty of from people. You had Hasidic Rebbes in Tel Aviv. It was much more of a center for religious life. And B'nai Brak was getting off the ground while walking on the streets. And this is how it's reported. And apparently this was in all the newspapers. He sees his wife. This is as classic a case of not just a Maguna, obviously, remarrying, but Mamzerus. The woman was still married. She had children with a second husband. These children are mamzerim. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank came up with a solution. I'm assuming the tshuva exists somewhere, although it does not appear in his book. We know that many rabbanim refuse to publish things if they're afraid that other people are going to use it in an improper way. We finished a Shemitah year last year. Rav Chilak of Weinberg was told by Rav Chaim Ozer that that's why Rav Yitzchak Chochamim Spector never published his lenient decision about the Heter Mechira, about selling the land during the sabbatical year. There's certain things that the rabbis were, they didn't want to put down in writing. I mean, we have other, Rav Tzvi Pesach will see other cases where he didn't want to put it down in writing. But this case, which shaving shoe, you mean shaving with an electric shaver? Okay, I didn't know he had an electric shaver. We have other cases where they didn't want to put it down for other reasons. Not because they didn't hold of it, but because then they saw that their position went against other people. Well, there is a response of Rav Aaron Cutler in support of the Heter Mechira, selling the land in the sabbatical year. Today, that is, and even at the end of his life, I think, that was so much against the mainstream Haredi world, the Chazon Ish, he apparently said that he didn't want it to appear. Now, I don't know if that's true, because he never published any of his writings. They all came out after his death. It could be that his grandchildren decided that such a responsum today, and the responsum exists. They acknowledge it exists, which is unusual. Usually they never acknowledge when they censor, but they acknowledge it exists, and they don't want to publish it. See, if you acknowledge it exists, that sort of defeats the point, because now everyone knows that he wrote it. But Rav Tzvi Pesach was for a different reason. Now let me tell you what he came up with. There is a view in the Talmud which speaks about how you... let me start over. I can divorce and marry with a messenger. That's well known to anyone who studies Talmud. So I can send a messenger to divorce my wife. What would happen if I sent a messenger to divorce my wife, and while the messenger was out on his way, I then canceled the messenger? The messenger would come, bring the get to my wife. It's a valid get with the rabbi's letters accompanying it, the signatures and all that. She's divorced, based on issues of divorce, and then gets remarried, and yet the get had been completely valid. Because I'm able to, according to biblical law, I'm able to void the get, no question about it.